dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This is a moment when we've had some bracing talk from President Trump about the nature of the war for the free world at his address to the United Nations General Assembly, including some very, very powerful, well, critiques, as well as, I think, identifying the United States with the people of Venezuela. And the critiques, of course, were aimed at the government there of Nicolas Maduro, who clings to power, it seems, substantially with the help of foreign nations like Russia and China. To talk about all this, we turn frequently to Russ Dallin. He is the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune. He also heads up the investment bank Caracas Capital Markets. He has spent a considerable amount of his life in Venezuela, in Caracas, and it's just a great resource for us. We're always grateful to him for his time. Russ, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's always a great honor to get to speak with you and address your worthy listeners.
Thank you. Well, listen, it's been a while since we've talked. You might pick up on kind of the comments that the president made. I guess there was some unease in certain quarters that that hardliner on Venezuela, John Bolton, having left the building, things might have taken a different turn. It didn't sound that way from what the president said the other day. Where do you think American policy is at the moment, and is that appropriate given what we're seeing on the ground continuing to play out there in Venezuela?
Well, it is certainly reassuring. There are a number of nations around the world that have allied themselves with the United States, and the route that the United States has been plotting to get Venezuela out of the terrible morass that it's in by being run by narco-trafficking dictators and who have no intention of leaving voluntarily or through that wonderful invention of modern democracy, the ballot box. So having said that, Ambassador Bolton was obviously a hawk and leading the charge on a number of the harder core issues around the world. Venezuela was in that list. His departure worried a lot of those countries and worried a lot of Venezuelans who are stuck in many different countries waiting to be able to go back to their country when it returns to the fold of democracy and capitalism. And they were concerned that Mr. Trump might not be so diligent on Venezuela. So Senator Rubio was among those and immediately talked to President Trump on the 12th that morning and immediately tweeted out that he had spoken with the president and that the president had said that he was he had disagreed with some of the views of his previous advisor, but he remained that very firmly to resolve the situation in Venezuela. And then President Trump, in the tweeting world that we live in now, retweeted Senator Rubio's tweet with saying that actually Ambassador Bolton was holding him back and that his position was actually much more hardcore than the hawk Ambassador Bolton. So that gave some reassurance to the markets and to the world.
His lips to God's ears, as they say. So, Russ, I see that it seemed to go without much fanfare, but that the United States and Colombia prevailed upon other members of something that I frankly had thought long since ceased to exist, the Rio Treaty, actually decided to invoke some of its obligations, I guess, in the face of what is continuing to happen in Venezuela. What can you tell us about the Rio Treaty and what it means that it's now been invoked by 19 members?
Well, it's a fantastic treaty because it actually predates NATO, and actually NATO copied a lot of the language of the Rio Treaty. The Rio Treaty was kind of the first test case after the United Nations was formed and after we had this multilateralism to try and stop these world wars and form a new world order that would resolve those difficulties between nations without having to go to war. There was an Article 50 of the UN Constitution that allowed regional organizations. One of those first regional organizations, even predating the Organization of American States, formed the Rio Treaty in 1947. And they basically agreed to use the language that later would come into the NATO, that an attack on one was an attack on all. But it also included war and going to armed force. It also included a number of other opportunities for resolution in terms of breaking diplomatic relations, recalling chiefs, interrupting economic relations, blockades, stopping communications, a number of other alternatives, which are important now because a lot of the Latin American countries are not supporting an armed intervention in Venezuela, and certainly there's, you know, the United States is not necessarily calling for that yet. But this gives them cover to be harder on Venezuela.
Let me just ask you quickly, Russ Dahlin, one of the things that has been critical, as I mentioned earlier, to perpetuating this horrible regime of Nicolas Maduro, despite the fact that these 19 nations and others have recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela, is the outside support that the regime is getting. And I saw earlier this week that Maduro was off to Moscow. Tell us what he's doing there and what the implications are for us of Moscow being engaged in our hemisphere in that way.
Well, you're absolutely right, Frank. Maduro, usurper, as he is known by the opposition because he's not legitimately elected, but is supported by Russia. And he is actually over in Russia, even as we speak, meeting with both the Putin, Medvedev, and the Secretary of Energy, Alexander Novak, and the head of Rosneft, Igor Sechin, which has a strong relationship with Venezuela. So strong, in fact, that Rosneft is pretty much directing all of the imports and exports of Venezuela's oil now. They are pretty firmly in control of it. They are also collecting the money. So we're actually seeing, China was, of course, has been in that help. We're actually seeing Russia ships, chartering ships, taking oil to China. So China has said, oh, they're not importing anymore, and they are not directly importing. They're using Russia as their beard to bring them that oil.
Interesting. And they're keeping it outside of their customs areas, as I understand it, so as to claim that they've not actually imported it, which is just another scam, of course, and enables them to continue sending money to or otherwise propping up Nicolas Maduro's regime. Russ Dahlin, there's much more to talk about. I hope you'll allow us to do so with you in the near future. Thank you for your time today and for the great work that you do, of course, at the Latin American Herald Tribune, as well as Caracas Capital. Be well, my friend. Come back to us in the near future, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West about, well, the cultural Marxism and other challenges we're facing from the swamp and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we have the privilege of being joined, as we do each week, by Diana West, one of the most thoughtful and, I think, insightful of our pundits, commentators, and writers on subjects directly relevant to the sort of condition of our country and the state of the national security that flows from it, of course. Diana is the author of three terrific books, The Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, the ideological drivers behind the anti-Trump conspiracy. You can also find her writings at dianawest.net. Diana, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back.
Well, I very interested in your thinking, Diana, as we listen, as we speak, to the testimony of the Director of National Intelligence, that is to say, the acting Director of National Intelligence, being interrogated or hectored or otherwise interviewed by members of the Congress concerning the latest of the manifestations, it seems to me, of the assault on Donald Trump, namely the claims that a whistleblower has made that he has acted improperly, and the impeachment hearings, that investigation that's getting underway to explore all of that. Give us sort of, if you would, Diana, how this particular drama fits into the larger context of what you've been studying in terms of the determined effort by people in the United States government to take out this president.
Yes, well, I'm glad you used the phrase larger context, because that is always what is missing in each and every of these successive whipped up, generated, contrived, hysteric rages that we've been experiencing since before President Trump entered the White House. And this is a very intense one, this impeachment inquiry, so-called. I call it impeachment light because, of course, we've seen no vote. This is another contrivance. It's another drama. I think so much of this is a dramatic scene staged, they hope, for the American people to be taken in by, you know, almost carnival barker style. But it is all part of a continuing effort to destroy Donald Trump as candidate for president, this time in 2020. And what it tells us is that the anti-democratic forces, anti-small-d democratic forces, are desperate, on the march, in their, you know, not extremis, I'm afraid. They are still very powerful, but they are not able to play by the rules. They have to go to these kinds of extraordinary concocted measures, and we're experiencing another one. And I think this one is different because so many people are onto it, but it's still very dangerous. It's very destructive. And, you know, you don't know where we're going to be when we come out of it, but this is sort of where we are going into it.
But does this fit into the larger pattern, for example, that you described in the red thread of essentially a kind of revolutionary globalist sort of cohort within the United States government that's determined to stop a counter-revolutionary in the person of Donald Trump from undoing their, well, the inexorable march, to use your term, towards that that promised land of a fundamental transformation of America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is of a piece. It is just the latest stand of this globalist movement that is confronted by the singular Donald Trump, as you say, the counter-revolutionary figure, absolutely of a piece, same players, same playbook. We're watching a repeat. People have noticed this already. So much of it is similar to what we watched with the Russian hoax. But this is unfolding so much more quickly, and it's compact, and it's abbreviated. But it's the same kind of drive, again, to deprive us of context, for example, of the phone call itself, to focus on the notion of do me a favor rather than all of the sentences and meanings around it, and to also take normal presidential behavior and conduct and discussions with world leaders into this realm of politicization that is absolutely outrageous and beyond our, I don't know of an example that we can, you know, see in our past that actually twins to this one. It is all, again, in the same pattern of what we've seen going up to this point, deflection. Now we're deflecting from the Biden crime family, if you will, what was going on with the payments, the gas company, Vice President Biden's own former vice president, discussions of what he did to basically extort Ukraine into behaving the way he wanted them to behave by holding out a $1 billion loan guarantee, over the investigations into his the company his son was sitting on the board of. I mean, this is, again, just as we saw deflection from what Hillary Clinton was doing, what Barack Obama was doing with colluding with our various adversaries and enemies. I mean, it's the same game.
Yeah. Diana, just to drill down on that for a moment, because I think what's so striking to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners, is that we're being told now almost like an incantation by the press and by Democratic partisans, I guess you'd say, that, you know, there's no foundation to the concerns about what Joe Biden did, that, you know, these are all groundless allegations. I mean, I can't quite get my head around that, given that we have the videotape that has him speaking directly of his involvement in crushing this investigation of a company for whom his son was serving as a member of the board of directors at an enormous cost and without any other apparent justification than he was the vice president's son at the time when the vice president had this Ukraine portfolio. And am I missing something here, or is this just an extraordinary bit of political, you know, sort of sleight of hand?
Right. A shell game. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's not intended to make sense. It's a matter of muscling the narrative over, having it repeated over and over again in the media echo chamber, in the House Democratic echo chambers. I mean, this is how big lies are generated. Again, going back, we have so much to look at that in terms of connecting to a larger context of manipulations of people, of citizens of different countries by totalitarian control centers through the repetition of the big lie. I mean, this goes back to Stalin. It goes back to Hitler. It's certainly Mao. I mean, this is the technique of the totalitarian. And this is what I mean when I see them as so, to their core, anti-small d democratic. They cannot compete with Donald Trump at the ballot box, and they know it. And so this is the any means necessary, which takes us to the larger context of Marxist seizures of power to destroy their adversary. And it is horrifying to watch, and it is destabilizing for a normal person to watch. It is, you say you can't wrap your, I can't, nobody can really wrap their head around this kind of evil, truly demonic kinds of behavior that are outside the traditional civilized means of communication, of political debate, of civil society. I mean, this is outside the normal. But it is confounding when there are so many adherents of this abnormal behavior. But this, I think we start to have to look back to, I was racking my brains thinking of different takeovers, for example, of Czechoslovakia after World War II, how the society was infiltrated, undermined, and they always talk about, the scholars of communism talk about how the Justice Department, their equivalent ministries, justice, security, and so on, are infiltrated, subverted, undermined. This is how you know that a country is ripe for tipping to that totalitarian point. And we look around us and see the exact same scenario here. And I don't overstate the case. I think Donald Trump is well aware of that. And I do think that in some ways we can see his attempts to work outside channels are actually what is driving them to a point of meltdown in this particular cycle, because he can be successful outside the swamp in ways he cannot be when his, all of the departments of the government, even at, in the executive branch, are absolutely swamp occupied. I mean, this is kind of the situation. I look at the White House these days and truly do think the Alamo. I hope the outcome is very different, but in terms of being alone, he is alone.
By nominal subordinates. Diana, let me take you to another piece of this Marxist agenda, it seems to me, the cultural Marxist agenda specifically, and that is the indoctrination of our young people. It's been much on display, of course, in recent days in connection with this climate change, well, children's crusade, I guess you might say, led in part by this young woman from Sweden, but also now large numbers of school children who get the day off to go protest and speak in increasingly, talk about hysterical terms about the imminence of the end of the planet and their lives and the rest of ours. And how has this come to pass, as you see it, with your understanding of how this kind of big lying and indoctrination and domination of populations takes place?
Well, as you know, emotionalism becomes the coin of the realm, the political realm, the cultural realm, the education realm, as opposed to logic and reason and facts, you do see this kind of behavior. And we do have examples in the past. I mean, it's interesting you use the word children's crusade. Back in the 60s, I found a headline, Mao's Children's Crusade, and they were talking about the use in Mao's Red China of young people in the Red Guard as part of the whole revolution that he was bringing to that country and destroying people by the million,
including their parents in many cases.
Yes, and this was a use of children, of young people. We see this in the young pioneers in the Soviet Union, whereby the young people who are indoctrinated from their early school days are the only ones who rise in the society. I mean, again, we're seeing these same patterns reemerging here.
Diana, thank you as always for your insights. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Marshall of Straight Ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Bill Marshall, one of my personal favorite guests. He is senior investigator at the indispensable Judicial Watch. He has been doing much of the spade work that we hear about almost daily in terms of the findings, the revelations, the legal victories, and other important insights derived by Judicial Watch, often through the use of Freedom of Information Act requests and sometimes litigation that flows when they are not honored as they are supposed to be by the executive branch of the United States government. Bill, you have served in a number of investigative capacities in and out of government over the years, but we're particularly grateful to you and Tom Fitton and Chris Farrell and the rest of the team at Judicial Watch for what you do in your current day job. It's good to have you back as always, my friend. Welcome.
Great to be back, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
You have put your focus of late on a couple things that I wanted to visit with you about quickly. One is a woman who has come to national prominence as a member of the freshman class of the House of Representatives, a representative from the state of Minnesota by the name of Ilhan Omar. Tell us what you've been finding out about Ms. Omar's past track record and some of the things that have contributed to your boss, Tom Fitton, suggesting that it's there's plenty to work with to open a criminal investigation of this representative.
Yeah, Frank, I think that, in talking to my old federal law enforcement pals, I don't think it's a question anymore of there being enough probable cause for the feds to investigate Congresswoman Omar for various and sundry crimes or potential crimes, but simply the political will that's lacking. As you can imagine, I mean, she's sort of held up as this paragon of the American success story. You know, of course, I view her as an America hater as well as an Israel hater, but she has been very credibly accused of having married her biological brother, presumably as part of an immigration fraud scheme. There are three really terrific, dogged investigative reporters who have done a tremendous amount of spade work in this area and have documented meticulously over the past 3 years, largely through her own social media posts, genealogical databases, public records in the UK and the US, interviews of confidential sources in the Somali community. In essence, what it boils down to is that Congresswoman Omar, her family had split up when she was a child, and half the family came to the US and fraudulently claimed to be a member of a family here by the name of Omar. Their real last name is Elmi. The other half of the family, two sisters and a brother, went to the UK, and they retained the name Elmi. Well, in 2009, I believe it was, Congresswoman Omar, quote unquote, married her biological brother on paper, a man named Ahmed Nur Said Elmi, in order for him to come to the United States. and they both attended North Dakota State University together. We believe that there may be student loan fraud implicated as you know, derivatively from this immigration fraud scheme. She also, when she finally divorced her brother, her presumed brother in 2017, she filled out a document in which she had to answer 8 questions. And we believe, and particularly David Steinberg, the three reporters, by the way, are David Steinberg, most recently of PJ Media, Priya Samsundar of Alpha News, and Scott Johnson of Powerlineblog.com. Those are the reporters that have really done tremendous work here. And what David and his colleagues have, you know, have concluded is that she perjuriously answered 8 questions in this official document signed under penalty of perjury. This divorce filing in a Minnesota court case. And she, there were a number of questions that she had to answer. One of which was that she had not seen her brother, her brother slash husband, nor had contact with him since June 2011. When in fact David has unaltered photographs of them meeting up together in London in 2015, and she signed this document in 2017.
So when you say perjuriously answered, she was lying. In other words, that is a federal offense, is it not?
Well, absolutely. And she's also, and this is not disputed. I mean, this is, she was also living with a man named Ahmed Hirsi. This is in Minnesota, and with whom she had 3 children. And she was never married to him. But yet she filed joint tax returns with this man. And this is not disputed. This is the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board has concluded that in fact she did this. And she was fined. She was also fined for using campaign finances for personal uses.
So, in other words, a whole slew of very problematic activities, and a case could be made. But just to cut to the chase here, is it your reading that, absent further revelations, perhaps, or further public pressure, there will be no action taken against this woman?
We have filed, I drafted for Tom Fitton's signature a complaint that we filed with the Office of Congressional Ethics on July 22nd, where we outlined all of this, largely relying on the fine reporting of our colleagues, David Steinberg and Priya Samsundar and Scott Johnson, where we laid all of this out. We believe she's committed marriage fraud, tax fraud, immigration fraud, and perjury, at least. And what other evidence does one need to at least launch an investigation? And then following that complaint, a few weeks later, back in September, a few weeks ago, there was a divorce filing submitted by a woman named Dr. Beth Manette here in Washington, D.C., in which she divulged that Representative Omar was having an affair with her husband, Tim Manette, who is a political operative here, and that Representative Omar's campaign had paid Mr. Manette $230,000 since July of 2018. Over $175,000 of that came after the November 2018 election, which was an easy election for Congresswoman Omar because she comes from a solid blue district.
An increasingly Somali district.
Right. So Dr. Manette essentially implies that in her divorce filing that her husband had been traveling around the country with Representative Omar for their personal pleasure, if you will, using campaign finances to fund his travel.
Last time I checked, there's a Congressman Duncan Hunter who's being prosecuted for doing that sort of thing in federal court at the moment. So I want to get, with the time we have left, to 2 other matters very quickly with you, Bill Marshall. But the bottom line of this is, this shouldn't be left simply to the congressional ethics committees, because they're notoriously lax in disciplining members. And I think that's particularly true of Democrats, but it's been true of some Republican-led committees as well. What other options are there? Is this not simply something that the Justice Department could put in train, criminal prosecution?
I believe they could. I've had conversations with some government officials, or let's leave it at that, in Minnesota, who have also wondered if there is not a means of getting the of getting official investigations launched more as a sort of intellectual matter. I mean, what does it take? And again, I think it comes down to political will. There's just a just a great reluctance on the part of agencies like the IRS and DOJ, FBI, to go after certain, to investigate certain people who have sort of been elevated and insulated to some degree by the liberal establishment.
It sounds as though this is more of that same story that you guys have helped the rest of us really get a grip on, and that is that there's a separate set of rules for liberal Democrats and leftists from the rest of us. And that's outrageous. And I appreciate, Bill Marshall, what you do at Judicial Watch to try to help counter that highly destructive thing for the rule of law, needless to say, and the public's confidence that it is, in fact, going to be faithfully implemented in this country. Bill, let me turn quickly, as I say, to at least one other matter. You have been reporting on, of course, what the administration was subjected to, Donald Trump, that is to say, even before he had an administration, in terms of a counterintelligence investigation. And I'm very interested in knowing what you've got going on that front. If you could quickly give us the distilled essence of it.
Right. Well, we just filed a lawsuit for a request I put in to DOJ for the infamous electronic communication, which launched, I don't want to say launched a thousand ships, but launched the anti-Trump counterintelligence investigation. This is an electronic communication that Devin Nunes actually had asked for.
The former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, now its ranking member, yeah.
Exactly right. And as well, he'd also asked for the same document from Rod Rosenstein. Both of them refused to provide the document. And this was, this is central. This is a pivotal record. You know, it's as I say, it was sort of the genesis of the counterintelligence investigation against President Trump, Operation Crossfire Hurricane. And he apparently has been able to view it, current Congressman Nunes, but the American public has not. And I would like to get that record. And so we just filed a lawsuit for that. It's a critical record. And I think it's one to which the American people are entitled.
I couldn't agree more with you, Bill Marshall. And I very much hope that at long last we're going to see it, because I do think it will help unravel what our friend Diana West was talking about a moment ago in terms of the red thread, the degree to which there has been a clear anti-Trump conspiracy and who was involved in it, and their techniques for trying to take down first a candidate, subsequently an administration elected by the people of the United States. But we have to leave it for that for the moment. Bill, thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work that you and your colleagues do at the outstanding organization Judicial Watch. I hope people will check it out at judicialwatch.org. Come back to us again soon, if you would, Bill. In the meantime, keep up the great work. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman about developments in Israel and elsewhere in the Middle East and what they might mean for all of us. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined, as we have the privilege of being just about every week, by David Goldman, one of the smartest guys I know, a man who has a professional métier, as they say in France, of finance, but has a very active sideline work as one of the great pundits and commentators and authors of our time. He is, among other things, the author of How Civilizations Die and countless articles that appear under his byline at Asia Times, Spengler, and occasionally under his own byline in other places on a whole host of issues. He is truly a Renaissance man, a good friend of mine and of this program. David, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Frank, I'm honored. Thank you so much.
Well, David, the honor is mine. Let me say I'm particularly interested in some of the things that you have been reporting on at Asia Times that are important context for the attack that shocked a lot of people and apparently surprised U.S. intelligence and military personnel, as well as the Saudis, namely what was evidently perpetrated by the Iranians against one of the Saudi central facilities in their oil infrastructure at Upcake. Tell us your reading of the backstory here and the possible role that the Russians and the Turks may have played in prompting the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps to take this action?
Well, the Revolutionary Guard's main strategic objective for the past 7 years has been to occupy Syria, expel the Sunni population, repopulate it with Shia immigrants, and turn Syria into a Shiite extension of Iran. The Israelis have been trying to frustrate that. As you know, they've conducted hundreds of bombing raids against Syria only in the past year, and they've done that by agreement with the Russians, who have a very mixed view of the Iranians. The Russians like the fact the Iranians have helped them keep their friend Assad in power in Syria, but the Russians also don't want the Iranians to get too big for their britches. They don't want a Shiite empire under Iran's control because they have their own Muslim problem. They don't want to get too big. So they've been putting pressure on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to withdraw from the Israeli border, to move 80 kilometers to the north. At the Ankara summit last week, the Russians and the Turks put pressure on Iran to try to limit the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And to some extent, the Revolutionary Guard action against Saudi Arabia was a way of saying, nobody's going to control us, including the Iranian government itself. They didn't want a meeting between Iranian President Rouhani and Trump. They didn't want any limitations on their imperial plans. So basically, you've got the Revolutionary Guard Corps under pressure from a number of sides saying, if you try to mess with us, we're going to blow things up. We dare you to try to attack us. And they're a hard nut to crack. So it leaves, you know, the U.S. with a number of difficult options.
Yeah. When do you talk about the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, David, I'd like to calibrate a little bit for our audience on where they line up ideologically. We had Harold Rode on yesterday talking a bit about this 12-er doctrine, which believes that they'll be able to bring back the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, the Messiah figure, by provoking the kind of outpouring of lamentation and grief, appealing for his help, that, well, might be triggered by something like the apocalypse. Do you see the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Soleimani and the like, as being people who embrace this idea and therefore may well be trying to provoke a very direct and very bloody conflict with not just the Saudis, but us and others, perhaps?
Well, Harold Rode is a great expert on 12-er Shiism. I'm not. I think the bottom line, though, is that the Revolutionary Guard Corps believes this is the Shiite moment. They have a chance to create a Shiite crescent stretching from Pakistan to the Mediterranean Sea, and Syria is the cockpit of that battle. So they're willing to risk everything to bring the Shia into leadership of the Muslim world after 1,000 years of being second best. That has certainly a millenarian messianic apocalyptic component, but there's also a very hard-bitten, practical, on-the-ground strategy, which is extremely dangerous.
It is indeed. You mentioned Turkey in the mix. I'd like to ask you to expand on the role that Erdogan is playing both in Syria at the moment and more generally in the region. We've, of course, been treated to some of his public comments in the course of his visit this week, among others with Donald Trump at the United Nations General Assembly. What's he up to, as you see it at the moment, and how serious a factor is he in making the problems you've just described even more intractable?
Erdogan plays all sides. He is ultimately a competitor of Iran. He's a Sunni. He wants Turkey to be the center of a new Islamic caliphate based on the Sunni strain of Islam. On the other hand, he is a major factor enabling Iran to thwart sanctions and finance itself through illicit gold trade and other means through Turkey. And of course, he's playing up to the Russians to get leverage against the United States. The people he's supporting in Syria are at war with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Our correct play, Frank, is to let Turkey and Iran fight each other. We should be manipulating the situation the way the British used to run things in the Middle East, and use the Turks as leverage against Iran while supporting the Kurds sufficiently to scare the Turks into doing what we want them to do. We need to play dirty, we need to play rough, and we're being much too nice to everybody.
Yeah, at our great peril, because in this kind of circles, nice is considered weak, and weak is considered exploitable, and it can invite all kinds of bad behavior. Turkey under Erdogan is apparently now actually looking to have nuclear weapons as well. Is that right?
Yes, and of course that would be extremely dangerous. I don't think it would be difficult to stop them from doing so. The Turkish economy is extremely weak. They're living on handouts from China right now. And that's yet another factor in the equation, because China has trillions of dollars of net foreign assets. China helped Turkey stabilize their currency after it crashed earlier this year. Turkey's in deep recession, but there are limits to how much China can prop that thing up if we really put pressure on them. It's a complex equation, and the Chinese are, of course, not being helpful, which is not surprising.
As usual. But neither is Erdogan, I think, is the point. And we persist in considering him to be an ally when I think it's evident to anybody looking at this objectively that he has long since ceased to be such. And that adds further complexity to all of this, doesn't it?
You know, but Frank, I've got friends like Michael Duran at Hudson Institute who think that we should support the Turks. I have other friends who think we should support the Kurds. I think we should do both. I think we should be using our influence to keep all sides off balance and make them afraid of us.
Well, that sounds more or less like the Trump policy, as far as I can tell, but we'll be monitoring this closely, as I know will you, David Goldman, at Asia Times and elsewhere. Very quickly, David, I did just want to ask your thoughtful assessment of what is happening in Israel at the moment. I understand that it's a messy bit of business and the politics of the place, but what's likely to be the upshot of the continuing turmoil as a result of this second inconclusive election in just a few months?
There's no choice but a national unity government. I think an alternating prime ministership between Netanyahu and Benny Gantz will, in fact, be the outcome of some role for Avigdor Lieberman, the sort of the Russian-speaking party in Israel, which holds a small but important balance of power. There is no real difference between Gantz and Netanyahu on strategic issues. Netanyahu will make more concessions to the religious right. Gantz will make more concessions to a secular side of Israeli society. That's a social problem which cannot be bridged easily, but I think there will be continuity in Israeli strategic policy.
Continuity is a good thing. Hopefully it will maintain its very important role in trying to preserve peace and our interests there, as well as those of Israel. David Goldman, as always, it's great racing, but very, very helpful to talk with you, and I appreciate you taking the time to do so. Thank you. Come back to us again next week, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Affney.